August 25th, 2010, right? And we're at the offices of the FCIC interviewing Mr. Rich Delmar, counsel to the Inspector General, Department of the Treasury. Mr. Delmar, my name's Chris Seifer. All of us are with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement Recovery Act of 2009 that tells us to determine the various causes of the financial crisis by the end of this year and deliver a report by December 15th. That statute tells us to look at various things, including any institution that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance. It tells us to look at the issue of too big to fail systemically important institutions. As part of that, we have been looking at the Wachovia acquisition by initially almost Citi and then by Wells. And during that investigation, we of course ran across the Wells acquisition and the issue of this IRS notice 2008-83 and have been trying to understand its impact and frankly specifically a lot of the stuff that it looks like you investigated that led to this memo you wrote on September 3rd, 2009. So with that, I guess probably the best place to start is can you just describe the events that led up to you taking on this task and preparing this memo, and then we'll get into the substance of your findings.
Senator Grassley wrote, and I'm not sure that I remember exactly, Senator Grassley asked my boss, Eric Thorson, the Treasury IG, in mid-November of 2008 to conduct an investigation, as he called it, into the IRS's or the department's issuance of this notice 2008-83. Which is supposed to provide clear working rules for the application of Section 382H of the Internal Revenue Code. Mr. Thorson decided that the best way to do this was, instead of conducting an investigation with 1811s, that I would do it. So the process was that he and I first met with Bob Hoyt, who was then the General Counsel of the Treasury Department, to discuss this and ask him to issue a memo to the entire Treasury Department, you know, a document preservation order, which they do fairly frequently. I then did a lot of research, determined who were the people that I was really going to need to talk to find out how this thing came to be and, you know, what the influences were on its creation. And you've seen the list of the people I interviewed. I did not interview Secretary Paulson, but I did forward questions to him through Williams and Conley and got answers. I did talk to Bob Hoyt. I talked to people in the Office of Tax Policy at the department and people at IRS Chief Counsel's office. And basically the it was clear that Senator Grassley's particular interests were, was there anything irregular or improper about the creation of this notice? And was there any purpose in having it so as to apply it in any way other than, you know, in a disinterested fashion? So I did a lot of study and I interviewed these people and drafted up Q&As, which they signed, and talked to people in the Office of Tax Policy who had done a costing analysis going out 10 years, how much the lost revenue might be if this this rule was used. And they estimated something on the order of $6 billion over 10 years. And as I pointed out, when ARRA, the conference report on ARRA, actually estimated $7 billion, which, you know, in government is remarkable similarity. The issue, that $140 billion figure, got bandied about a lot after Jones Day publicized it. And, you know, there was no indication over how long a period of time, how many unlikely factors would have to simultaneously occur before all this would happen. And so at the end of it, I wrote a memo, which is not the final memo you see here, and we submitted it up to Senator Grassley's staffers. And then Mr. Thorson and I went up to a meeting in the Senate Finance Committee's offices with these staffers, and they wanted more than I had provided. So we agreed that I would do more study. And specifically what I did was to look at the applicability of the Congressional Review Act to see if, you know, that was in play and had been violated in some way. And also to, you know, I thought to gather as much as possible whatever critical commentary there had been about the creation of this notice. So I did some more research. I also obtained Secretary Paulson's office calendars, and based on that, I submitted the questions to his lawyer. And his lawyer specifically said that those calls to Bob Steele and to whoever the head of Wells was.
Kovacevic?
I don't remember. Okay. The guy with the name Stumpf, I think, too.
Okay, right.
Had nothing to do with this particular issue. And I had actually gotten from Senator Grassley's staff an exchange of correspondence between the senator and Wachovia, in which they asked Mr. Steele for all the records he had relating to contacts with Treasury about this particular issue. And a woman named Jane Sherborne, who I guess is the general counsel of Wachovia, wrote back and said, there weren't any such contacts, so we're not giving you anything because there's nothing to give you. End of story. So at the end of it, I still could not find any indication that anything improper had been done here. There were some rather technical errors, like delays in getting notices from IRS chief counsel's office up to the Hill. What I found really interesting was this agreement between Treasury and OMB relating to the major rule determination under the Congressional Review Act. And as I pointed out, you know, this is interesting. It seems to leave a lot of wiggle room, and that's something somebody might want to look at. But it wasn't really within the core of what I was tasked to do. So, and at the end of the exercise, I still came to the conclusion that I couldn't find anything that was illegal or improper. Certainly there were critical commentaries on the creation of this thing, whether it made sense, whether it was in the authority of the Treasury Department to essentially re-legislate, if you had that point of view. And the conclusion I came to was, well, there's also a number of articles, critical articles, that say, yeah, they could do this, and yeah, it's not a bad idea, and no, it's not, usurpation of legislative authority. And to me, that's what makes a horse race. And in the end, of course, Congress mooted the whole issue by, negating the effectiveness of the notice in one of the sections of the Recovery Act. So that's what I did and why I did it, and what my understanding was of what Senator Grassley's staff was looking for.
Okay, so let me ask you, I've had a chance to read the memo, the September 3rd, 2009 memo that you wrote. And I had a couple of questions that I hope you can help me with. On bottom of page 2 through page 3, you talk about the purpose of the notice and how you talked to Mr. Solomon, Ms. Gilbreth Soule, and Mr. Countryman. And in particular, on page 3, where you talk about Assistant Secretary Gilbreth Soule, mm-hmm. It says that during the late summer of 2008, it became increasingly aware of and responsive to concerns in the financial community regarding the potential negative impact of 382H's loss restrictions on efforts to strengthen troubled financial institutions, and that Section 382 was seen as discouraging bank acquisitions by limiting the use of tax losses. And similar comments regarding the mm-hmm. others. How did the note? I understand that this is what folks had concerns about, but who actually initiated the note from Treasury or whoever from where initiated the notice coming out in the first place? Do you know that?
I'm not 100% certain whether it was the Office of Tax Policy, which is in the departmental offices and to whom the IRS does not actually report, or the IRS. But the consistent explanation that I was given was that this was not something that was dreamed up overnight to benefit any particular merger, any particular institution, that it's something that people had been talking about for a while, that in fact there had been a prior notice, 2008-65, that also dealt with interpretations of 382H. So what I was told was that it had been in the works for a while, and how you define a while, I'm not sure. And I think it might have been more of a theoretical discussion that suddenly had practical implications when, you know, there was concern that the ability of stronger banks to take over weaker banks and thus remove that problem from, you know, whoever, the FDIC perhaps, or whoever, was being harmed because the valuation issue, which is needed in order to compute what the losses are, couldn't be determined. So that's basically what I was told. I didn't see anything. You know, when I talked to people, as I said, in the chief counsel's office and Eric Solomon and his deputy, and I didn't get any indication that, you know, their stories were diverging at all, and I didn't get any indication that they were hiding something, that this was really, the fix was in to help, you know, some particular bank or banks.
When you talked to Assistant Secretary Gilbreth Sowell and who indicated that the OTP became increasingly aware of this issue, is it a she, by the way?
Yeah.
How did she become aware of this issue? Did she say,
Let me get her Q&A. I just got to remember which number it is.
Okay. And generally what I'm getting at is still sort of my previous question. What's sort of the catalyst for let's get this thing out, on September 30th, 2008?
Right. Well, and again, I started out my questioning of her was, when were you first assigned to work on the notice? And her answer was during the late summer of 2008, OTP became increasingly aware of and responsive to concerns in the financial community regarding the potential negative impact of 382's loss limitation on efforts to strengthen troubled financial institutions. OTP undertook several efforts to determine what steps could be taken expeditiously by administrative action to ameliorate these difficulties. So that was her explanation.
And understanding that that's the written, did you actually talk to her or did you submit?
Okay. All of these people I interviewed, I took notes, I then typed up what I thought was, an accurate and complete summary of what they had said, and then I sent each to that person and said, please go through this. If there's anything you disagree with, anything you want to add, please do so.
And did, whether it was Assistant Secretary Gilbreth Sowell or anyone else, did any of them say, how they became increasingly aware or if where the message was coming from? Hey, look, we've got this problem in the financial sector and we need to deal with this and get it done.
I think Eric Solomon, who was the actual Assistant Secretary, and again, my focus, based on what the staffers were telling us was important to them, was a little bit more on how they did it. I mean, the fact of using a notice as opposed to a revenue procedure or even a formal revision to the tax regs, there was some question about that along with the question, isn't this really, legislate? Is this really changing the impact of the statute rather than providing guidance to it about it? And that seemed to be reasonable. People could differ on how they interpreted that. Is it half full or half empty? So my focus was a little less 30,000 foot than that.
Understanding your focus was more on that issue as opposed to what I asked. Nevertheless, did anybody in your interviews tell you, this is what started it, this is what the catalyst, what was it, you know, was it Hank Paulson saying, look, I'm dealing with all these financial institutions that are getting in trouble and I need to get this notice passed? Or
no, I got no indication. In fact, I didn't really get any indication that Paulson was particularly aware of or involved in it. I think it's possible that Eric Solomon might have given either he or the deputy secretary a briefing at some point, but I did not get the impression from anybody that this was really on Mr. Paulson's front burner.
Okay, and did you get any sense of what the catalyst was that resulted in? I mean, you'd mentioned that the previous summer, you know, 2008-65 was issued, but I mean, the timing is more than a little coincidental, right?
It is coincidental.
So I'm curious about what leads to it coming out, and if you don't know, that's fine. I'm just, you know, quizzing you.
I don't
to
know.
See if you recall. Okay. Next, in one of the other things you talk about in this memo is how, you know, the intent of the notice was to apply certainty and uniformity for valuation.
Well, this is what the people who were responsible for it were telling me,
right,
consistently.
I understand. And one of the things that you wrote in here, so on page 3, I think you write in the bottom, right before section 2, you write, the goal of the notice and other guidance was to make it easier to determine loss and thus encourage acquisitions. And then describe to us, if you can, what the actual effect of the notice was. My understanding from talking to other folks was that the main impact of the notice was on when new bills built in the net unrealized built-in losses could be recognized,
right,
whether they can be recognized up front or over time or whatever. I didn't, until I read your memo, understand that it may have also impacted how you valued assets that then led to that level of new bills that would be recognized over some period of time.
That's the explanation that I got. Mr. Solomon said that. I don't think Ms. Gilbreth specifically said that. I was really asking her different questions. Pretty sure Mark Countryman said that. And I'm also pretty sure that Bill Alexander, who's the Associate Chief Counsel for Corporate over at IRS Chief Counsel, that was his view of things. I don't think Henry Schneiderman, who's a senior special counsel over there, he was really more on the procedural end of things.
Mm-hmm.
But Alexander was really the technical guy heading the Office of Technical People.
Mm-hmm. On page 5 of your memo, in the last paragraph, you're talking about some of the criticisms of it. And in the middle of that paragraph, it's written, these critiques noted that the statute strictly limits the amount of losses existing in a bank targeted for acquisition that can be used after the acquisition by an acquiring bank to lessen its own tax liability. They observed that the effect of the notice was to remove such limits, both in amount and in reach back to earlier tax years, and that this amounted to administrative revision of the statute's clear intent without proper legislative action. Do you know whether or not the latter part of that, of whether it was, you know, administrative revision, but do you know if in fact it's true, if that critique is accurate? Did the effect of the notice remove the limits and allow larger losses that could be used to shield taxable income going forward?
It's my understanding that it did. And the stated purpose of it was to allow some certainty as to the amount of losses when you were in an environment where it was difficult to make valuations of, in this case, loans, you know, what their actual value was given the heightened risk that was associated with them. Again, as I said, when I did work in the tax realm, it was both at the Justice Department and at IRS on the criminal end of things, where you don't get into nuances like this. And I looked at and actually made as exhibits here a number of the articles that I found. And there were a number of them, certainly, that were critical of the theory behind this and of the department's ability to do what it was doing. On the other hand, there were other articles, presumably equally qualified sources who said, you know, this is fine, it makes sense, there's nothing wrong with it, it's not really re-legislating. And that was, I think that was one of the central points that I was focusing on and was trying to get across in the memo that I wrote, that like most other complex subjects, you can get different opinions from different people, and there's nothing really that says that one is absolutely right and the other one is absolutely wrong, and there's certainly nothing that says that, you know, if you don't agree with me, you're doing it for some, you know, improper purpose. The impression I was left with was these were people who were convinced, possibly had convinced themselves, but definitely were convinced that, you know, the system was in great jeopardy and that they needed a way to find an ability for stronger banks to take over weaker banks before the weaker banks collapsed, and that this was perceived as being a barrier to the accomplishment of that because of this valuation issue. And as I said in my memo, I think it's not an outrageous argument. It's a plausible argument that, yeah, this did, you know, whatever the line is between interpreting a statute and rewriting the statute, you could argue that this crossed that line. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, the experts who held the opposite view, you know, I didn't think were out to lunch, and I didn't think they had any improper purpose. And again, you know, the stories I was getting were consistent, and I found no basis to have a reasonable suspicion that anybody had, you know, an improper purpose in this, i.e. to benefit a particular bank or that somehow some fix was in.
Mm-hmm. So I hear you saying that you didn't find that there was, you know, any purpose to benefit any particular bank. But is it accurate that you're also saying it, and it sounds like from what's written in the memo, that a purpose of it was to benefit the financial industry overall because of the problems that were going on at the time?
Yeah,
is
I think
that
that's
accurate?
Okay. I don't know that I put it exactly that way, but yeah. I wouldn't disagree with that.
I'm sure you put it much more articulately. And then on page 6, you talk about this question that Mr. Coughlin or Coughlin. I don't know how you pronounce
Coughlin,
it.
Actually.
Coughlin. That's my old boss's name is spelled the same way, and it's also a hard G. Coughlin. And this indented paragraph says the rationale given for Notice 2008-83 was that given the frozen state of the market, new bulls were too difficult to value, and thus banks could just value them at zero. I don't understand that given what your understanding of the general purpose was. Is that saying, I mean, if you're valuing the new bulls at zero, how does that help an acquiring institution? Because then you got nothing to shield income going forward.
I don't know.
Yeah. Now, okay, so let me ask you this, what I thought it might be. Could it be, or do you know, given the difficulties in valuing assets that lead to the new bulls, was it that, look, if we have this illiquid asset, loans that banks are making, we just value them at zero, and therefore have a much bigger loss and a much bigger new bull, and therefore much more to shield income going forward. Is that?
I suppose it's possible.
But
I don't know enough about it to have, you know, a warranted opinion on it.
Okay. Other than the written questions to Mr. Paulson's attorneys, did you interview anyone at Treasury? And I don't mean IRS people, but just Treasury, you know, like Paulson people on Treasury.
Yeah.
And who did you interview there?
Bob Hoyt, who was the general counsel. Eric Solomon, who was the assistant secretary for tax policy. His deputy, Karen Gilbreth Soul. Mark Countryman, who had been from tax legislative counsel's office, I believe. So those are the people from, and then two people in kind of the statistical department of the Office of Tax Policy, Mr. Mackey and I can't remember the other guy's name. They're the ones who did the estimation of what the impact on revenue would have been.
Okay. And do you recall, I mean, we know the notice was issued on September 30th, and maybe I just missed it in here, but when prior to that did the push come to issue 2008-83? Do you know how much earlier it was?
The best impression I have is that it was a matter of, I gather, a few months. But, you know, people talked about in late summer, which I took to be probably around this time of year, there was concern. But how much before that, I don't really know.
Okay, well, late summer around now would be a month, less than a month before it was issued, yeah. Not months.
I think it would have to have been longer than that, just the bureaucratic process. Even if, I mean, everybody said that doing this as a notice as opposed to a reg or a rev ruling or anything else or a rev proc was chosen because there was nothing improper about it and it was more expeditious. You know, expeditious is a relative term. And certainly, you know, it makes sense to me that doing it this way rather than amending, you know, the internal revenue regs, you know, it would have been a lot quicker. But I don't know when the first time was that somebody said, you know, hey, this is either a problem now or it's going to be a problem, you know, if a bad set of circumstances come along.
In the folks that you did interview, though, did you ask them, you know, when did the push come to, when did you start working on this again?
And yeah, I did specifically ask. And, well, for instance,
you should have gotten these from you earlier. Been more prepared to ask you questions.
Well, if you want to make a copy now and then call me up with follow-up questions.
Let's finish, but I think we would like to do that, actually, and then see if it's necessary to follow up. That would be very helpful.
Eric Solomon doesn't appear to have... Okay. I asked him who wrote the information memorandum for the Secretary on potential tax impediments on large investments by financial institutions, and Solomon said that his deputy and Mark Countryman, the lawyer, wrote the initial draft of this memo in July 2008. So that's okay. Midsummer.
Right. Okay. And is that memo that you're referring to in that interview part of the binder in that?
I don't remember one way or the other. I'm going to have to double check that.
But if nothing, but one of the things that appears to be part of the catalyst for 2008-83 is this July 2008 memo that gets written?
Apparently. Okay. Deborah Gilbreth, or Karen Gilbreth's, I asked her when were you first assigned to work. She said late summer of 2008, and I didn't clarify, was that June, July, or August?
Could be June.
Could I jump in? Did a number of people say to you late summer? Was that a common phrase?
Yeah, that was pretty consistent, or summer anyway. Okay. She said late summer. Eric said July. Mark Countryman said, I said, when were you first assigned to work on this notice? I first became involved in this matter in early September 2008. So, and I said, I asked who assigned you. I had a close working relationship with the Office of Tax Policy and was asked by Eric Solomon to become involved. This was cleared with the Office of General Counsel. What were the issues involved? Starting in late August and continuing into September, there was growing evidence of systemic problems in the financial sector and a growing likelihood of weak banks failing and increased consolidation. It was also apparent that 382 could complicate and even discourage capital infusions, investments, and acquisitions of weak, loss-laden banks. The theme of OTP's work was that tax rules should not be obstacles to financial transactions and acquisitions that were otherwise good for the economy. So that's what he said. Bill Alexander, the Associate Chief Counsel at IRS, I asked him, when were you first assigned to work on this? I became involved specifically with this notice in mid-September 2008, though we have been working on guidance projects in this area of the tax code for much longer. And I asked him about the relationship between Chief Counsel and OTP, and you know, he explained that. It's kind of two sides of the same coin. Let me see who else answered that question. These are some of the articles that I found. That's about it.
Okay. Of the folks that you talked to, who seemed to be the most knowledgeable about this issue?
I would say Eric Solomon had been I mean, he was the boss of the operation. Clearly, he was very dependent on help from Karen Gilbreth and Mark Countryman. He was the one who told me who they were and that I should talk to them. Bill Alexander, as the head of the whole corporate section in IRS chief counsel, clearly knew a fair amount about it. And one of the exhibits in here is a letter that Eric Solomon wrote to Senator Schumer, which kind of lays out what their view of the issues was. And I don't think Eric wrote that letter by himself. I believe that he had help, probably from two other people I just mentioned. But they, a couple of them said, if you want a good explanation of what our concerns are in all of this and what we think this is going to do, look at the Schumer letter. So I made that an exhibit. Exhibit 10. And that was actually written in December of 2008. Right. So it was kind of after the fact.
Right, I think I've seen that letter, actually.
Okay.
And then, I don't hopefully not to look in the binder again, but who wrote the July memo again that we were just talking about?
According to Solomon, it was largely written by Karen Gilbreth and Mark Countryman.
Okay, okay. And he directed... I'm sorry, I'm getting my names mixed up. So Mr. Solomon directed Sowell and Countryman to write the memo, correct?
That's what he said.
Okay, and right. And then did Mr. And that memo gets written in the July 2008 time frame, right? Did Mr. Solomon say why he told them to write that memo?
Let's see. Well, I kind of shifted the questions after that. It's obvious that I saw the memo because my next question was, who was the private equity investor cited in the memo who suggested the bar to investing in struggling financial institutions? And Solomon said he didn't know. He thought that Tony Ryan, who had been the acting under for domestic finance, had a meeting which Solomon didn't attend with someone who raised the issue. I learned about the meeting later, although I cannot remember exactly how. The other thing Solomon said, it's important to note that as the financial crisis developed, the secretary asked each policy office to consider actions that could be taken within existing authority to address market difficulties. Section 382 is one of the many areas in the tax law that we reviewed. We've issued more than 24 guidance items to address tax issues, including 5 items relating to Section 382. And he goes into what their considerations were, and then I asked him if this was an appropriate use of the notice process as opposed to some other process, and all he said was, yeah, I believe that it was. As far as I know, it was written in compliance with the Internal Revenue Manual. And then he denied having any contacts with anybody associated with Wachovia, Wells, or any other financial institution. That's pretty much what he said.
Okay, and when you're saying he there, you're talking about Mr. Solomon?
Yes.
Okay. So did you ask Mr. Solomon, if, for example, if Mr. Ryan had any contact
no.
with any of those institutions?
I didn't.
Or if anybody else at Treasury did?
No, I didn't.
I think what it probably makes sense to do is for us to make a copy of that and look at it and then follow up, because I'm noticing that most of my questions result in you looking at your binder, and I don't want to waste your time. Uh-huh. So would that be agreeable with you?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's why I brought it over, so okay. That you could make a copy of it.
Great. So we'll make a copy. I'll make Gordon review all of it, and then we'll call you back if we have any follow-up questions. Just anybody that you interviewed not listed in the memo?
Go ahead. I want to see.
Did you consider interviewing or doing any type of investigation to see if anybody in the financial services industry, you know, was suggesting to Treasury that, hey, this would be a good idea?
Well, I kind of did that. I mean, I looked at, you know, the correspondence between Grassley's office and Steele's office. And as I said in the memo, you know, since they had already asked those questions and had gotten, you know, a negative response, I didn't see that it made a whole lot of sense for us to ask the same questions all over again and get the same response.
Sure.
And the other thing, some of the staffers asked why we didn't, you know, just do a sweep of everybody's emails. Well, that's a pretty monumental task, and absent some reasonably specific allegation that, you know, there's something in there that's going to indicate misconduct, you know, it was, and the other thing to keep in mind is that as an IG's office, we have a fairly limited jurisdiction. You know, we ought to look at problems in the programs and operations of the department. And actually, since the IRS has its own IG, there was an initial question, should our office be doing this at all, or should it be sent over to TIGTA? And the resolution was that Senator Grassley wanted our office to do it. And I talked to the chief counsel over at TIGTA, and they didn't have any problems with that.
It may be in here, and I apologize if it is, but other than Grassley asking for that information from Wachovia and getting the response from General Counsel Sherborne that we don't have any documents for you because there weren't any discussions, were there similar requests from other financial institutions?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, so you don't know that Grassley sent a similar request to Wells Fargo, for example?
No, although since I got this from one of his staffers, I assumed, and that's always a danger, I guess, that if there had been, they would have wanted me to know about it, since they gave me this exchange with Wachovia.
Okay, great. Well, why don't we make a copy of the binder, take a look at it, and then we'll give you a ring if we have any follow-up questions. They're very helpful. Thank you very much.
All right. I can just leave this with you. It's clearly going to take some